You're tuned into All Together Now, the new WGXC evening news show, Monday through Saturday, 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.7 FM. Today, we'll talk to Dutchess County-based artist Linda Weintraub and Ulster County-based gallerist Michael Asbill to discuss Weintraub's participatory art show, Grandmother Earth, that opens May 15th in Ulster County at the Church Project Space in Cottical near Stone Ridge. We'll also talk to Hudson City School Superintendent Maria Suttmeyer and School Business Administrator Sherry Carbon about the upcoming school board elections May 17th and other issues facing the district from an interview on the WGXC Afternoon Show May 11th with Vern Cross, Rainer Blue, and Kamel Johnson on WGXC. And we'll also hear reports from Albany, Germantown, Kinderhook, Rensselaer County, Catskill, Selkirk, and Greene County on All Together Now.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for Thursday, May the 12th, 2016. I'm Philip Grant. Jim Plank is reporting in the Daily Mail that police have new information on the Audrey Mae Heron disappearance. Heron, a 31-year-old married mother of three from Freehold, disappeared in August of 2002 after finishing her shift at the former Greene County Long-Term Health Care Center in Jefferson Heights. Neither Heron or her black 1994 Jeep Grand Cherokee have ever been found. State Police Senior BCI Investigator Peter Kaminsky said on Wednesday, May the 11th, the state police are actively investigating a couple of new leads. He said police were looking at an area on Cartersgill Road and Cartersgill Creek in Catskill on Tuesday, but nothing relevant to the case was found. Kaminsky said the circumstances and locations of the other leads could not be divulged because the investigation remains active. State police ask anyone who might have information about the case to call 518-622-8600. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. Roger Hannigan-Gilson and Katie Kosajansky are reporting in the Register Star that U.S. Senator Charles Schumer said on Wednesday, May the 11th, he will seek to retrieve untapped federal funds to expand broadband service in New York. The funding was scheduled to be rerouted to other states after Verizon Wireless failed to use the money in New York. The funding came from the Federal Communications Commission's Connect America Fund. The six-year-old award, totaling $170 million, was intended to expand broadband service to rural areas. The money was offered to Fairpoint Communications, Frontier Communications, Verizon Wireless, and Windstream, Schumer said. The reason behind Verizon's failure to use the federal funds is unknown, Schumer said. The Connect America Fund money was available for the eastern two-thirds of Columbia County and the area of Greene County that borders Delaware County, according to the FCC. Columbia and Greene counties have the worst broadband coverage in New York, according to July 2014 data from the State Broadband Program Office. You can read that full story in the Register Star. Melanie Lekachevic in the Greene County News is reporting that the U.S. Department of Labor ruled CSX Transportation violated a federal safety act when it suspended a Selkirk-based employee who reported numerous alleged safety hazards. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, fined CSX more than $32,000 in damages and attorney's fees for its action against the whistleblower. The employee, a union official, sent a letter on September 6, 2013 to his supervisor detailing alleged safety hazards and violations of the Federal Railroad Safety Act. Management gave the whistleblower a five-day suspension on December 18, 2013, and I quote, for an alleged safety infraction, end quote, OSHA officials claim. Then in March 2014, the employee raised the issue with a complaint to OSHA. CSX must pay $27,735 in attorney's fees and $5,000 in punitive damages, as well as expunge his employment record of the suspension. You can read that full story in the Greene County News. The Albany Times Union reports that honey production statewide increased 9% in 2015, with more than 3.6 million pounds produced. New York is the top honey producer in the Northeast, and now for the first time in a decade, among the top 10 states nationally. State officials say beekeepers earned about $10.6 million last year, up $1.2 million from 2014. You can read that full story in the Albany Times Union. Matthew Hamilton is reporting at Capital Confidential that the New York Civil Liberties Union filed suit against the state and Governor Andrew Cuomo over the state not allowing farm workers to organize. Cuomo, it seems, agrees with the NYCLU, saying in a statement on May the 10th that the flaw in the state labor relations law is, and I quote, unacceptable, end quote, and may be in violation of the state constitution. Cuomo said, and I quote, I agree with the NYCLU that the exclusion of farm workers from the Labor Relations Act is inconsistent with our constitutional principles, and my administration will not be defending the act in court. We will not tolerate the abuse or exploitation of workers in any industry. This clear and undeniable injustice must be corrected, end quote. The New York Farm Bureau was not happy with Cuomo's statement. Farm Bureau President Dean Norton said in a statement, and I quote, the NYCLU's assertion regarding farmers and their treatment of their employees are erroneous, insulting, and disparaging, and we are frustrated that the governor's statement does not even recognize that fact. Up until now, he has publicly praised the dairy industry and agriculture in general for the good jobs that they create. It should also be pointed out that farm workers are not the only employee class that does not have the ability to collectively bargain by virtue of the nature of their job. The governor's position in choosing not to defend the state's labor law represents a disservice to farmers that make up the backbone of our rural economy, end quote. You can read that full story at Capital Confidential. And for our final story, Katie Kozajanski is reporting in the Daily Mail that a new countywide public transportation system will be available to Greene County residents beginning next month. The system will operate as a partnership between the county and Ulster Green ARC. Ulster Green ARC routes will be open to the public as of June the 1st. Greene County Transit will offer five daily routes, Monday through Friday, plus a Catskills shuttle run. The system will also offer daily routes, including one to Hunter on Wednesday and another to Windham on Friday. Director of Greene County Economic Development, Tourism, and Planning, Warren Hart, said the merger with ARC had been in the works for a while. He said public feedback on the system is not only encouraged, it is needed. Hart said seven new buses will be operated by ARC, and all the buses will come equipped with a wheelchair lift for handicapped accessibility, two-way radios, dual GPS systems, backup cameras, an internal security camera system, and a public address system. The transit system's website will launch at the beginning of June. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail.
National Weather Service in Albany predicts overnight, there is a chance of showers after 4 a.m. with a low around 50. And then Friday, there's an 80% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm before 3 p.m., a high near 64. Friday night, the chance of rain continues and gradually becomes partly cloudy with a low around 47. Saturday, there is a 60% chance of showers or a thunderstorm, otherwise partly sunny with a high near 67 and a low around 36. Sunday should be sunny with a high near 51.
All Together Now listens for feedback from the public. Anyone who wants to leave a public comment can call 518-291-9492 and leave an audio message up to 3 minutes with any sort of opinion about something you heard on All Together Now. You can also send emails to info@wgxc.org with opinions about what you hear here.
Say it again. You can someday. We'll You are listening to the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. While the U.S. Congress has yet to investigate the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, Kinderhook-based Congressman Chris Gibson wants to hold hearings over the water in Rensselaer County. Kenneth C. Crow II in Capital Confidential reports that Gibson is asking the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform to investigate the PFOA contamination of drinking water in Hoosick, Hoosick Falls, and Petersburg. Quote, critical questions regarding the actions of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, New York State Department of Health, and New York State Department of Environmental Conservation remain unanswered, the congressman wrote. Quote, regrettably, the New York legislature has changed course and now will not conduct oversight hearings on what went wrong and why, after stating they would be holding hearings in the matter. This has only increased frustration and concern amongst many of my constituents and myself that our regulatory agencies are not facing the necessary and appropriate oversight of their agencies, end quote. Read the full story in Capital Confidential. Debbie Mayer reports in the Columbia paper that the Germantown Planning Board says a retail store on Route 9G could have a negative environmental impact in the town. The story does not indicate exactly how a retail store, in this case a proposed Dollar General, would have a negative environmental impact in Germantown, but the Germantown Planning Board voted unanimously April 28th to give the project a positive declaration for the State Environmental Quality Review, SEQR, process. A positive declaration is what the state calls a determination of significance for the proposal. Like other retail outlets in Germantown, the proposed 9,100-square-foot store would have a parking lot, lighting, signage, a loading area, and landscaping. There will be public meetings in the next few weeks on the issue, the story says. Read the full story in the Columbia paper. The Daily Freeman reports that Dean Skelos, the former state majority leader, a Republican, in Albany, was sentenced May 12th to 5 years in prison and a $500,000 fine for extortion, fraud, and bribery. Earlier in the month, former State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, a Democrat, was sentenced to 12 years in prison for a similar corruption case. Despite that news, legislators in Albany have done little this session to reform ethics or transparency. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Bill Mahoney in Politico New York reports that a few different names topped the list of spending by lobby groups in Albany in 2015. The Pro-Tax Credit Invest in Education Coalition, the labor union New York State United Teachers, and charter school advocates Families for Excellent Schools topped the list of lobbyist spending. Two groups intent on changing votes in the 421A tax credit, the New York City and vicinity Carpenters Labor Management Corporation and the real estate-backed Putting New Yorkers to Work, were fourth and seventh in spending. Only the teachers union had been on previous top 10 lists of lobbyist spending in Albany. Read the full story in Politico New York.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for today, Thursday, the 12th day of May 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
I'm here today with Linda Weintraub and Michael Asbill. And you guys want to introduce yourselves? Tell listeners who you are and why you're talking to us today.
Well, my name is Linda Weintraub. I have lived in the Hudson Valley for a very long time and contributed to the art experience here in many ways. But this is the first opportunity. I will not be a curator, not be a writer, not be a lecturer, but will actually be exhibiting my own work at Church Project Space, which Michael Asbill is the director of.
Uh-huh. And I'm Michael Asbill, and I am the director of Church Project Space, which is in Cottekill, New York, just outside of, well, just between Rosendale and Stone Ridge. I used to run another gallery with a couple of friends in Kingston called K-Mocha, I'm an artist and also have lived here for quite a number of years, and also live on a farm here in the Hudson Valley. So it's great to be on the show.
And is the Church Project Space new?
Church Project Space is relatively new. We've been we're on a slow start. We're kind of ramping up. We've done a couple of projects each year for the last 2 years. The first set in collaboration with Women's Studio Workshop, and then two independent projects. So this will be our first full season this year.
And Linda, can you give us all the details about the show before we begin too much? When's the opening, and is there a reception and that sort of thing, and how long is the show up?
The show is based on a concept, and the concept is that as an artist, I look for ways to do what environmentalists all seem to want to do, and that is get the public back in touch with the materials and the systems and the rhythms of the environment that we live in, and deviate from our immersion in constructed environments and contrived materials that we humans have done. So that is the basis of the exhibition, which means it is a participatory exhibition in which I will present a work of art that utilizes the materials that are so rich with their history of the geological and biological forces of the Hudson Valley, things like seeds and mushrooms and twigs and bark and other kinds of organic material. And this will be available for the public. So it opens on May 15th, but basically it is an ongoing project that will continue until the end of June. And the public is invited to participate anytime in that period by calling to make an appointment or coming on Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. when it is just going to be open. And I will be there guiding this process of interaction as we go along. So Michael's space is conducive to this. As a matter of fact, it tends to be its mission, which is to involve the public in art projects. And it was perfect for my own desire to provide people with an opportunity to interact with these materials that have all been foraged from the Hudson Valley.
Well, you led into my next question perfectly. For both Linda and Michael, your past work has included participatory public works before, or is this new? Or what kind of success have you had with getting the public to participate in art?
Sure, maybe I'll field that one. My personal work does sort of involve engagement. It's a big part of my practice. And when we decided to bring or put Church Project Space together, we felt like engagement was a critical component. We wanted to see audiences diversified, drawing more from the general populace than we've seen in the past. Linda's project, as she said, is really perfect because she's actually planning to meet with as many people as she can and get them involved in her project in like a workshop type of way where they come in and they play a part in the general project. They'll help build it.
Linda, have you had past participatory works?
I have written about other people's participatory works, but I have never tried one like this myself. But I guess to complete Michael's statement about my show, there will be a culminating event at the end of the exhibition when I'm hoping all those who have contributed will gather. And actually what I hope is that people will be stopping in throughout the 6 weeks to see how the work evolves. So it's an active kind of art event, which will take place over those 6 weeks. And I think it's a little unusual in that it has of long duration. Many participatory artworks take place in an afternoon, and then people go home and don't involve themselves with it again. But here's an opportunity for them to come back and bring their friends and neighbors and perhaps people who have never even been to an art museum or an art gallery before.
Linda, what's the difference for you of instead of writing about a show or curating or putting it together to putting it on?
Actually, I was trained as a studio artist. I got my MFA degree. So the question I'm more typically asked, and this is kind of funny that you've reversed the order. Typically, people will say, how is your writing and curating a part of your studio art practice? And there my answer is, I approach everything I do based on the training I've had as an artist. So when I put on an exhibition or I write a book, I'm thinking about what am I trying to say and what is the form of communication? What are the metaphors I can use to communicate this? Who is my audience? And so I tackle all those projects as if I was doing a book that was an artwork or an exhibition that is an artwork. So here I'm just coming back home to the studio and working more directly with mediums that I have been dealing with on my homestead intensely for many years, but haven't translated that into an art exhibition before.
And how is was it a dichotomy, or is it, I don't know what the word, or I guess the word's up to you. You're trying to show people about a natural environment in a artificial environment indoors. What is the tension there?
Well, actually, we're hoping that a component of this will be people going out and foraging for their own materials. But what they're going to experience when they come inside is really an art experience. Because I asked myself, what can I do as an artist to encourage people to reconnect with this abundant and diverse world of matter that is so little a part of contemporary lives? And form and color and texture is definitely a part of that. So what I'm going to be presenting is not just the opportunity to interact with acorns and bark and fur and feathers, but to arrange them in a manner that is inherent to the way that the seasons change, weather conditions are altered, lighting changes from morning to noon to night, which is always a gradual progression. It is very harmonious without any divisions and boundaries and borders, which is exactly the kind of visual experience that humans, when they construct their own environment, give us. So it's completely the opposite of the right angles and the harsh contrast, which is so much a part of the commercial, commodity-driven advertising world. And it's an opportunity to use these materials in a manner that captures the aesthetics of the outdoors.
And what is the name of the show? Did we mention that?
I've given it a name, and this too says, it was in response to my question to myself, what can I do as an artist to communicate something that so many environmentalists are trying to accomplish? And I said, well, I have at my disposal as an artist the opportunity to work with metaphor. So I have created a metaphor as the title of the show, and that is not Mother Earth, but Grandmother Earth. And if I'm going to tell you, is that consider the Earth Mother, it means that we are dependent on her, that she will be our provider, that we are not responsible for her, and it casts us perpetually as children who are dependent. But just by putting the grand in front of mother, I'm hoping it will trigger a whole different set of associations, and that is grandmother Earth is not as vigorous as Mother Earth. She will need our help, our consideration, and we will be rewarded for assuming that responsibility because she also has great wisdom.
Michael, can you give us the details of the, where the gallery is, and tell us too about any other shows coming up?
Sure. Church is at 167 Cottakill Road. In Cottakill, which, as I said, is right between Rosendale and Stone Ridge. If you just look up that address and put it in your phone, I imagine you can sort of drive right to us.
And what's the web address too?
The web address is www.churchprojectspace, and that's CHRCH. There's no U there. CHRCH Project Space, all one word, .org, .org. So you can find out about our shows there. In addition to Linda's show, we'll also be showing the work of Steve Chlorfine. I should say we're actually going to be having a project by Steve Chlorfine and a project by Wayne Montecalvo later in the summer. We're also arranging right now our fourth show, which is by Moira Williams, which will happen in the fall.
And your shows are more happenings and events than they are typical art?
Yeah, there's always a culminating event where people can come out and really appreciate what the artists have been doing in that space. But ultimately, our intention is to sort of bring as many people in the space and have them be active participants in the artwork that's being produced. So that's really our underlying mission, involvement. We really want to see the community involved.
And Linda, do you have a website people can go to for more information about your work?
Sure. It's www.lindaweintraub.com. And I just want to use this opportunity to issue an invitation to whoever might be listening to participate. The project depends on lots of people from lots of different backgrounds coming through, and everybody is welcome.
Do people need to be prepared in any way to participate, or...
I'm asking everybody to call me first at my email address or my telephone, all of which is posted, and I will talk to them about exactly what they want to do. So I'm happy to tailor the visit to their needs and their interests. I'm hoping that people will organize their own groups, come with their own friends, and this can be church groups or gardening groups or art gathering groups or salons or whatever it might be. And so that will depend. If they want to do foraging, then we should come dressed for foraging. If they want to do an indoor project only, then of course that would require no special dress at all.
And again, this is at the Church Project Space, from May 15th to June 30th?
Correct.
And what are the hours?
Well, it's totally dependent on these sort of... let me start that over. It's totally dependent on the workshops. We'll be open during the times when Linda's there providing workshops. But every Sunday from 2 to 5, Linda will be available there, you know, leading workshops for the general public.
One thing that hasn't been said is that the Church Project Space earned its name well because, Michael, do you want to tell its history? It is a little church.
Oh, yes. It's an old Dutch Reformed church that was built in 1898. I think it was decommissioned 30 or 40 years ago, has been in artists' hands since then. But as far as I know, we're on the third artist owner.
Time for radio news about radio waves.
Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. The New York Times reported that Michael Ratner, the civil liberties lawyer who also hosted the Law and Disorder radio show, which originated on WBAI and airs on WGXC at 10 a.m. Mondays, died May 11th from complications of cancer, according to his brother Bruce, the property developer and an owner of the Brooklyn Nets. Ratner, 72, may be best known for successfully challenging the United States government's detention of terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay without judicial review. He also headed the Center for Constitutional Rights and sued New York City to end wholesale stop-and-frisk policing.
This is Law and Disorder.
Law and Disorder with co-host Heidi Boghossian and Michael Stephen Smith is a weekly syndicated radio program discussing access to rare on the radio legal perspectives on issues concerning civil liberties, privacy, the right to dissent, and torture. I'm Tom Rowe for Wayfarm Radio and WGXC. Next, Vern Cross, Rainier Blue, and Camille Johnson from the WGXC Afternoon Show on May 11th talk with Hudson City Schools Superintendent Maria Suttmeyer and School Business Administrator Sharif Carbon about the upcoming school board elections May 17th.
Here with us.
Let's do it.
And I'm going to put some respect on the name because the one thing that made me laugh is that, did I forget that she was a doctor? Maybe I forgot, you know, because maybe people don't say it enough. But when I realized it, we started saying that you have to use a doctor before that. We are honored to have Dr. Maria Suttmeyer, the superintendent of schools, in the building with the Drive Time team. I have to give you the applause. Sorry, guys. I'm saying she's a doctor. I'm saying applause.
Getting corporate on us today.
Hi, Maria. How are you today?
I'm good. Gee, thank you for that introduction. That was
I worked on it. I worked on it all night. I said, I can do this. So before we get started, I know that outside of the budget, and that's the very most important thing, but there's three seats open on the same day for the school board, correct?
That's right.
And the vote is that same day, right?
That's right.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure because sometimes when there's votes for the school board, like for all the other elections, it's in the paper and everybody knows about it and it's posted everywhere. But it seems like the school board votes are never posted anywhere and you just don't know about it. Like, oh, I mean, when Joey Carr ran, we knew about that. And then I think when Tiffany Hamilton ran because she had came to us and asked for some help. Yeah, I did throw that in there, but we go way back. But that's the only way we knew. But a lot of people, they might not even know where they have to vote at, more or less that there is an actual vote.
Right, so there's three open board seats, and there is bios on each one of them on our website. But we only have two people that are on the ballot. We have three seats, so someone can be written in.
Okay.
So if anyone expresses an interest in the community, they can be written in, or if somebody wants to nominate somebody, they can.
Okay. I just wanted to get that out of there.
Yeah, well, thank you. Tuesday, May 17th, three open board seats.
Okay. So let's talk about the budget.
Okay. So slight increase this year. We are the only school district in Columbia County that had a reduction in state aid. We got about 0.5% less than the surrounding school districts. The reason for that being that we had taken most of our gap elimination adjustment back in prior years. And also with decreasing debt service on our buildings, we didn't get as much in aid on our buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 0.5% decrease. So we do have a tax levy that we are asking for voter support. It's 2.15%, and the overall budget is $45,910,371. Okay. So it's an education plan that we really talk about in the district. It's you're voting on the number, the budget, but you're really approving what the education plan is for the students of the Hudson City School District in the 16-17 school year.
Okay. I'm listening.
Okay. So, you know, we're really pleased that we don't have any cuts in staff this year, that we're really proud of the fact that we've been working hard to come off of the state designation of being a focus school district, and we want to keep that momentum going. We're actually adding some key positions next year that provide additional support for our students that are learning English as a new language. We have a growing population of students that have mandated instruction time that they need. Also, academic intervention services, a reading specialist we're bringing on, and a certified secondary English and dually certified special education teacher so that they can not only teach the English content, but also use the strategies that are needed with our students that are identified for special services.
Okay.
The other added position this year for additional support for our students is a certified social worker at the secondary level. We find a need that we want our guidance counselors focusing on guiding our students towards college and career readiness, getting them prepared for what lies outside of the high school. So we want to remove some of the social emotional work that they're doing with students and give that to a certified social worker so that they can see the students for that guidance that they need for preparation after high school. So we're really proud and think we have a well-rounded plan for next year and keeping a lot of other programs that have been influential in helping us to get off the focus status and improve our school climate and culture and make sure that we continue those as well as add on additional services, not becoming overly staffed with mm-hmm. unnecessary positions, but things that are really key positions for our students.
That's great.
How did you determine these positions that to be key for the district?
Right. We meet as an administrative team, so it's always a systemic look at our K through 12 grade levels and talking about what programs are in place that really seem to be making a difference in the lives of our students, what we want to preserve, and then areas where we have been seeing a gap, you know, an increasing of students coming in with English language learning and knowing that the mandated services that we need to provide for them, the need of the social-emotional development of our students. The board, when they helped us to set our goals for the Vision 2020 this year, added a fourth goal. So we're not only raising the bar of our academic expectations and closing the gap amongst our diverse subgroups of students and aligning our curriculum instruction, they felt that it was really important to have another element that's not academically based, but based on helping our students to understand the world around them and to survive day to day with all of the changes that are going through them from adolescence to young adulthood.
With the budget, when people go to vote, it's yes or no. What happens if, God forbid, if the budget doesn't pass? Then what happens?
Well, I'm going to pass it over to our school business administrator, Sharifa Carvin, because she is really connected to the budget and what would happen if it did not pass.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome
Thank
back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you for having us. If, God forbid, the budget were to not pass, there are two options. The board could opt to present a second budget, either the same budget with further explanation or an adjusted budget, or the district could go straight to what's called a contingency budget. A contingency budget has very strict limitations, so a lot of services and programs that are deemed non-essential would be eliminated. Sports, for example, we would be reduced to just spending the same amount of money that was approved last year. So those would be the two options. If the district opted to go out for a second vote, we could try again with the same number or a different number, see what happens. But the numbers that we have presented that the board approved have been very strategically thought out with consideration of the taxpayers, with consideration of the needs of our students, first and foremost, but keeping all those options in mind. And I also want to point out, even with the capital project that was approved, we've been very deliberate in ensuring that the steps we take and the stages that we implement the project and the financing thereof are very much in line with what's necessary to the district, but also necessary to the community in terms of the financial needs, to make sure that everything is steady, that everything is stable. We don't have huge rises or fluctuations in the budget or the tax levy. So it's been very deliberately thought out and planned and collaboratively, not just from the business office, but with the administration as a whole, the team, with several conversations and looking at the district as a whole and the community and the needs thereof.
I mean, what's a takeaway to someone who's not the casual voter? What's like the speaking point that's going to make someone say, maybe I'll go vote this time? Like, what do you want to?
It is critical that everyone in the community go out and have your voice be heard, so that your vote represents, just as in politics, with our school district budget, these are our children. This is their education, but this is also the community's investment in those children. So whether you have children in the district or not, whether you're a single person with no children, whether you're a senior citizen, this is an investment. You're speaking about the investment in the community that you live in. And one thing that I've learned since I started with the district in December that I'm very proud of is that Hudson is very community-oriented. The community has rallied together in several instances, and it made me proud to be here, proud to work here, proud to be a part of the collaboration, and our children are impacted for the better because of it. So each and every person should vote and have their voice be heard for the good of the community, for the good of where we live, well, where the citizens of the Hudson City School District live, and where our children are going, because that's our future.
And similar question to Maria. Because I know, like, when sports is the hot ticket, you know, that usually like gets people jumping.
When she said that, I was like, whoa, well, everybody better vote.
That's usually, you know, the... Like,
wait, no sports?
Yeah, the worm out that gets thrown out there.
Right, because we have, if you go to a contingency budget, mm-hmm. you cannot have some of those things in your budget. You have to have really an austere budget that just has what you absolutely need to educate students. So sports is one of the first things to go. There's other mandated programs too, but there was a year that I can remember the Booster Club really mm-hmm. rallied behind to raise money to make sure that the kids had at least some teams playing and some sports going on, because we know that all kids are not into books and, mm-hmm. and math, and while we want to hook them and have them come in and learn all of those vital skills that they need to be successful someday, we need the sports so that the students feel that sense of accomplishment, self-esteem, be able to find that sense of belonging within the school where they excel, and then we can interest them in some of the other things that are available to them, such as the academics. So it really is a well-rounded education, a well-rounded student that we're looking to provide for through this budget. And I know as a taxpayer that it's hard to, you know, look and say, oh, you know, now another 2%. But, you know, with rising costs and with the mandated services that we need to be able to provide for that. We happen to be a very high human resources organization because we're people teaching people. Mm-hmm. And with that comes some, you know, expenses. So I'm hoping that people do come out and vote and do support the students' learning and all of those other things that go with it.
Yeah.
Just on a numbers basis.
Just move a little bit closer to the mic. They're saying they can't hear you.
What I'd like to add is this. The budget increase between this year and last year is less than 1%. So although the tax levy increase is 2.15%, the district is making up lost revenue. We've lost revenue from the state, which Maria has already spoken to. We've lost financial support that we had because we were in focus. So it's wonderful we're out of focus, but we were able to still do that so that the supports that our students need and the development that our teachers need to do what has to be done for our students is still in place.
Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, May the 12th, 2016. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, today is the day the presumptive GOP presidential nominee expected to have a much-anticipated meeting with the Speaker of the House. We'll let you know why your local convenience store may stop accepting EBT SNAP cards, and we'll tell you where forecasters now expect a very active wildfire season.
Topping our news, the stated goal, striving for party unity. Today, Donald Trump expected to meet with Speaker Paul Ryan. The Washington Post set the stage this way. When he arrives, Trump will have nearly clinched the GOP nomination by running squarely against Ryan's vision of what Republicanism is. The Post notes among their sharpest policy disagreements, entitlement programs. Ryan has advocated turning Medicare over to private insurers, while Trump says the program should stay as it is. Your local convenience store may no longer accept cards for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Suzanne Potter explains that's the deal if a new rule proposed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture goes into effect.
Opponents expect the matter to come up at a hearing on the SNAP program today in the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture. The rule says if 15% or more of a store's profits come from hot foods, the store will not be allowed to accept SNAP's electronic benefit transfer cards. Jawad Ersani, who owns five convenience stores in Los Angeles, says 80 to 90% of 7-Elevens would be affected, and that could be a major problem for the millions of Americans who live in a so-called food desert, where the nearest grocery store is more than a mile away.
Our stores are placed in communities where these people rely on us to feed them. We're talking about not only economically challenged, but physically challenged people.
SNAP is intended to be used to buy basics, such as milk and eggs, and is not supposed to be used for fast food.
Public comment on the USDA rule is open until next Wednesday. Hundreds of Michigan mothers, along with other family members, feel the daily pain of having a child locked up behind bars. Mary Sherman tells us a new report called Mothers at the Gate by the Institute for Policy Studies details the effort by family members to challenge the conditions in which their loved ones are held, as well as mass incarceration itself.
Lois DeMott's among those featured. Her 15-year-old son was sent to prison, and she says there were no support groups to help her once he was locked up. So she started Citizens for Prison Reform in Michigan. DeMott believes parents and community members need to pool resources so they can help each other.
There is so much stigma having a loved one inside of the system, and so many families go through this experience alone, walled off, without knowing where or how to find the support.
The report calls for juvenile justice reform, including raising the age juveniles can be transferred to adult prison, ending solitary confinement, improving conditions in youth prisons, breaking the school-to-prison pipeline, and ultimately ending the imprisonment of children.
Connecticut continues to make progress toward ending homelessness, according to the latest count. Andrea Sears reports the annual survey released Wednesday showed a decrease of almost 4% in overall homelessness compared to last year.
That's the lowest since the statewide counts began in 2007. And according to Lisa Tepper Bates, director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, the reduction in the number of chronically homeless individuals was even bigger.
We have made significant progress in housing those who are longest homeless and highest need, and we've seen a 20% drop in that population.
In February, the federal government confirmed that Connecticut had achieved the first goal of the National Zero 2016 campaign, ending homelessness among veterans. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
One of Illinois' largest gas providers on the hook for more than $18 million over misleading statements about the cost of upgrading its aging pipe system.
This comes after the former owners of Peoples Gas admitted to deceiving customers and state investigators. The company originally claimed the program would cost about $4.5 billion, while the actual cost was closer to double that amount. Jim Chilson with the Watchdog Citizens Utility Board says Peoples Gas used the deceptive practice to get state regulators to approve a merger with the gas company's current owners.
We're hoping that this settlement, which totals about $18.5 million, that this is a warning to all utility companies. If you mislead state regulators, you're going to pay for it.
In a statement, however, the gas company's new owners, WEC Energy Group, did not acknowledge any wrongdoing, but merely said it was focused on upgrading Chicago's natural gas infrastructure. I'm Brandon Campbell reporting.
And finally, Arizonans recently watched with concern as a mega wildfire swept across northeastern Alberta, causing more than 100,000 people to be evacuated. Mark Richardson reports forecasters say the same conditions that caused the blaze in Canada also could bring a very active fire season to Arizona and the Southwest.
Northern Arizona University climatologist Wally Covington says conditions are ripe for a higher than normal number of wildfires.
The outlook is for some pretty active fire through at least
the month of June in the lower elevations. Starting in June, we expect to see more active fires in the high countries, and we would expect that to intensify through August.
Covington says conditions across Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Southern California have been hotter and drier than normal this year. The National Interagency Fire Center agrees with that assessment, predicting above normal fire potential for the region in May and June, returning to normal during the monsoon season in July and August.
That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford from Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
National Weather Service in Albany predicts overnight there is a chance of showers after 4 a.m. with a low around 50, and then Friday there is an 80% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm before 3 p.m., a high near 64. Friday night, the chance of rain continues and gradually becomes partly cloudy with a low around 47. Saturday, there is a 60% chance of showers or a thunderstorm, otherwise partly sunny with a high near 67 and a low around 36. Sunday should be sunny with a high near 51.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
This is Timer with the community calendar for WGXC. Go to WGXC.org and you can add events to the community calendar. Just click on the Add an Event button at the top of the community calendar page at WGXC.org. Copy and paste the information about your community event in the boxes, and soon folks like me will read your event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it at WGXC.org. Friday, May 13th, the Hudson Historic Preservation Commission meets at 10 a.m. at Hudson City Hall. There will also be protests on the Hudson River in the afternoon from kayakers, canoeists, boaters, and more against oil shipments on the Hudson River. Friday, May 13th, Claverack Library has a book sale preview, and there's a big public meeting in Hunter at 6:30 p.m. at the Mountaintop Library Friday, May 13th, as Hunter's town board is considering repealing or changing two of six recent laws passed, and there was a standing room only meeting in April about these new local laws. That's at 6:30 p.m. at the Mountaintop Library in Hunter, Friday, May 13th. The Treble Choirler's spring concert is at the Catskill United Methodist Church at 7:30 p.m. May 13th. Gideon's Knot is showing at the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill. The Last Minute Jazz Ensemble performs at the Old Chatham Quaker Meeting House Friday, May 13th at 7:30 p.m. Time and Space Limited opens the Underneath the Above show number 1 from the Bread and Puppet Theater at 7:30 p.m. Friday, May 13th at TSL in Hudson. Tariq Atui plays at MPAC in Troy Friday, May 13th. Mishka Shubale and Star Anna are performing Friday, May 13th at the Half Moon in Hudson. Tony Corraldo, Stuart Quimby, Otto Hauser, and Terrence Murren play improvised music at 8 p.m. at the Spotty Dog Books and Ale Friday, May 13th. Girls Guns and Glory perform at Club Helsinki in Hudson.
Next, it's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
Our Song of the Day comes from Sam Baker, who's playing at Club Helsinki in Hudson Thursday, May 12th. This is Waves from Sam Baker.
Their own kids grown. said he'd be fine when she was gone. He walks down to the ocean, bends to touch the water and kneels to pray. Writes her name in the sand, waves washed away. There are seagulls that serve as shrimps. They turn inside the bay, and there's an emptiness inside. It never goes away. He walks down to the ocean. He bends to touch the water, kneels to pray. Writes a name in the sand, waves wash away. So many years and so many hardships, there's so many laughs, so many tears, so many things he cannot remember, 'cause they had 50 years. He walks down to the ocean, bends to touch the water, kneels pray. He writes her name in the sand, waves wash away. He writes her name in the sand, and waves. Oh, they